Shall we start, everybody? Has everybody settled? You're right up the top there. I've got this extremely important announcement to make. It's not that important. Don't be so worried. As you all know, I'm an apparatchik now, organisation man rather than academic, and I'm afraid that means that I can... Because I've got to go out fundraising for the LSE, I can only give this lecture and another lecture to finish this course, not the fourth lecture. So I'll be trying to cram a fair amount of stuff into this lecture today, and then it'll just be one last lecture in the course, in which I plan to talk about current political debates, especially the global debate around third way politics. So I hope most people will be able to come to that. That would be a week today, but I'm afraid I won't be able to come to the following lecture, which was originally planned. So please accept my apologies on that. If you remember back to last week's lecture, I mentioned that 1999 is a significant anniversary because it's the anniversary of the end of the bipolar world, that is, the opening of the Berlin Wall. I want to tell you a couple little vignettes about this because just by chance I was in Berlin the night the wall was opened. No one knew it was going to happen, you know, at the time. We were having a conference not very far from where it happened. So we all, we were told that it was going to happen and we went down to the Berlin Wall. And people were putting ladders up against it, you know. It's a real moment of history, and like all moments of history, it somehow seems unreal when you're taking part in it, but people putting these bloody ladders up against the wall. And we all started to try and climb up these ladders, but we were actually stopped by the TV crews. TV crews said, please don't climb these ladders until we get up first and we film you coming up to make history. And interestingly enough, they even took more than one shot. Some people had to climb up twice, you know, while they were being filmed, so they got good footage. I want to suggest to you in a second that there's something serious about this because in a globalized, mediatized world, television does have enormous impact. That impact has an interesting relationship to the expansion of democracy across the world. But another thing happened that same time that really stuck in my mind ever since. As I say, no one knew the Berlin Wall was going to be open when we were there on this weekend initially, so I went through with some people from West Berlin through to East Berlin about a couple of days before that happened. And I probably most people here too young, not everybody, I can see, too young to have done this, but going through the Berlin Wall at that time was a very unpleasant experience. The East German officials and guards were really horrible to you. They sort of looked brutish. Well, we know they shot people. And they looked really hostile and blank, you know, like really distant from any human involvement with people going from one side of Berlin to the other, really hostile. But the day after the Berlin Wall opened, and was then, you could just go through, you know, you weren't stopped at the border, these same people were just sort of friendly and smiling, just like any other person. And I don't know, it's just stuck in my mind because you ask yourself, which was the true person? Was it the original individual is a kind of expression of the totalitarian regime in a way, but at the same time they seem to be ordinary people, and this ordinariness seemed to be genuinely warm and spontaneous the next day when we were going through the wall. Anyway, this isn't as relevant to the theme what I'm going to talk about today as the initial example of the impact of television on these things. What I want to talk about today is the impact of globalization, the impact of globalization on the expansion of democracy and what future we should look to for the further expansion of democratic government, both within the industrial countries and elsewhere in the world. To initiate this discussion, I have to go back to last term's themes, which, and the theme of the whole lecture is really the fate of socialism and Marxism. Symbolized, the disintegration of these ideas, symbolized by the very opening of the Berlin Wall. Marx had a particular attitude towards democracy, which had a long-term consequence, really, for the history of the 20th century, at least up to 1989, and perhaps you could say afterwards, because after all, communist officialdom is still in power in China, and China makes up about a fifth of the population of the world. So these ideas are still with us. They haven't completely disappeared. No one is completely sure, I think, among those who spent their lives studying Marx, as it were, how democratic Marx himself was, because Marx had quite an authoritarian streak. He sought to change history. You could argue starting a movement, changing history, it's not easy to be democratic in those circumstances. And certainly you remember that Lenin, when he came into power in Russia, added to Marxism the idea of the vanguard party, that you had to have a tightly disciplined party at the head of an effective revolutionary movement. And such a party could not directly be democratic. I mean, Lenin looked for a sort of democracy in this, but he said it can't be democratic in the way in which ordinary liberal thinkers think of democracy. Well, Marx seemed to have a roughly similar idea, although Lenin added to it. Marx certainly was highly critical of Western liberal democracy, parliamentary democracy, explicitly critical of parliamentary democracy. He was critical of parliamentary democracy mainly because he thought it was something of a sham, a device to keep people happy, but which was not effectively democratic. The reasons for this, and you have to remember Marx was writing midpoint of the 19th century, crudely put were the following. Marx argued that in a so-called democratic country, first of all, only a minority of people have democratic rights. This was true of 19th century European societies. You had to own a certain amount of property before you were allowed to vote. Moreover, as Marx pointed out, women in most countries did not have the vote at all. In most Western countries, women didn't get the vote until well into the 20th century. So Marx says, well, you know, you have claims to liberal democracy, democratic society, but the majority of the population are excluded from participating. That was one aspect of his critique. The second was that liberal democracy is confined only to one aspect of life, namely that you get the chance to vote regularly for people in elections, but that's all. In a democratic polity, Marx said, of a liberal democratic kind, when you walk through the factory gates, and after all, most people spend most of their time in work, there is no democracy at all. You are simply placed under the whim of your employer, who can hire or fire you. This is certainly true of the 19th century, more or less at will. Marx therefore argued for, as it were, radicalization of democracy. First of all, he wanted the things which all of us, I think, would now accept as normal and reasonable. That is, he wanted universal franchise, and he wanted women to have the vote along with men. These things have happened, of course, in Western countries and many other countries through the world. But secondly, in regard to his second aspect of this critique, he wanted an extension of democratic rights into the workplace. And he wanted, as it were, a more substantive form of democracy than simply voting every 5 years for people who look more or less the same anyway, belonging to different parties. So he therefore, although he made only rudimentary suggestions about this, he wanted economic democracy. He wanted a democracy of the workplace. And he wanted a more fluid democratic system than simply voting every 5 years or 3 years, or whatever it might be, provides. He looked to the Paris Commune of the late 19th century as a kind of example of that, where there was much more turnover of personnel. He thought people could be recalled more frequently. He didn't have a kind of bureaucratic party structure. He thought you needed a more fluid kind of participatory democracy. And these things taken together were supposed to be a kind of radical movement beyond existing liberal democratic systems. Now, what happened in practice was that socialism, after Marx's time, tended to divide into two. In Western countries, the dominant form of socialism, even when it was influenced by Marxism, and you should remember that most socialists of all persuasions through most of the 20th century have been strongly influenced by Marx. This is true of most countries, Britain being a partial exception. You have the rise of what's normally called parliamentary socialism. Parliamentary socialism, and this is the reason why many more radical Marxists criticized it, is an accommodation to the institutions of liberal democracy. Parliamentary socialism is Labour parties or socialist parties agreeing to accept the framework of a parliamentary system, agreeing to accept the existence of other parties in competition with them, and agreeing to the routines of elections and so forth. In Western countries, most socialist parties, however little or much they may have been influenced by Marx, became parliamentary socialist parties. They did not set out to challenge the framework of liberal democracy, although many of them thought they would challenge it in the longer term, actually, through parliamentary mechanisms. But mostly they accommodated to it and sought to work within it. This is also sometimes used to be called reformist socialism. Reformist socialism, because orthodox socialist and labor parties look more for progressive reform rather than any kind of revolution or revolutionary change. However, in those parts of the world which followed Marxism through revolution, where revolutions were made by Marxist parties, they had a different kind of system, sometimes called democratic centralism, and sometimes called by the doctrine itself, Marxism-Leninism. The importance of this type of system is that it's based on the idea of the Soviet or of a one-party democracy. In those societies, the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and so forth, you either have a single communist party which didn't allow for any competitors at all, or else you had a dominant communist party in which other parties were tolerated but had no effective political power. The theory underlying such societies, I think it's very important to remember, however, was a Marxian version of radical democracy. What the East European countries and the Soviet Union turned into were highly authoritarian states in which the mass of the population had effectively less power than is true in Western countries. I don't think many people would, in hindsight, question that. But they were supposed to be democratic. They called themselves people's democracy, people's democracies, as China still does. And the idea is that political parties represent class interests, so that when you overcome classes, you don't need multiple political parties. You can have a system of representation of Soviets or collective election representation that can go right the way through from the grassroots, middle level, right up to the top level of the political system, and that this can involve economic decision making as well as political decision making. The theory, therefore, was democratic. The reality, I think, was certainly different. The idea of radicalizing democracy in this way simply did not work. It produced a society, a form of society, which effectively precluded the very democratic mechanisms it was supposed to recognize. So when you get to 1989, and when you get to the opening of the Berlin Wall, and this system, well, it's already crumbling through the changes I mentioned last week, I think you can say that this is part of a process of global democratization. That is, the Marxian idea that liberal democracy, multi-party democracy, is not democratic enough, and that it can be supplanted by a single party system of representation did not work. If you could say that socialism did not work economically because centralized economic management ran up against its limits in a globalized economy, you can say much the same thing with regard to the political system of Soviet-style societies. Soviet-style societies, it's not just they weren't democratic enough from their origins, they were running up against other changes going on in the global arena, pushing for greater democratization. Greater democratization, wherever it ends up, certainly begins with a liberal democratic system, that is, with parliamentary representation and with multiple parties. No one at the moment, just as no one at the moment knows any alternative to a globalized market society, the question is how do you make this society work effectively? There is no known socialist alternative anymore, radical socialist alternative. The same thing has turned out to be true on the level of politics. No one any longer knows on the level of the direction that Marx looked of an alternative to parliamentary democracy. Now, there are interesting things happening to parliamentary democracy, which I'm going to go on to discuss, but the Soviet Union, and socialism more generally, seems to have proved largely a dead end, both in terms of economic management and in terms of democratic representation. That's the reason, these two things are the reasons for the underlying the crisis of political thought today, the more or less universal crisis of political theory, which we are all involved with and struggling with, I think, throughout the world. Now, to understand what's going on, to understand not just why the Soviet Union crumbled, but what is going on in the arena of democratization, I want to propose to you in this lecture, you have to pursue the themes I mentioned in the last lecture. That is, we live in a world subject to radical globalization along the dimensions I mentioned last time. Globalization is the reality of the late 20th century. The changes involved in this not only structurally underlay the demise of Soviet communism, and I think the eventual demise of Chinese communism too, but also underlie the possibilities and the limits of democratization which we see all around us. And these are very well indicated in this little document here, which is supposed to have been passed around to everybody. If you compare 1975 with 1995, or even more so with 1999, if this table were updated, what this table shows is a generalized global process of democratization. Very, very interesting phenomenon. Concentrated over something like the past 20 or 30 years. And remember, the period of intensifying globalization that we're talking about is precisely that period. I dated it with the advent of global communication systems established towards the end of the 60s, early 1970s, the first time at which there was a global satellite system spanning the Earth, making possible instantaneous communication across the Earth. So we're talking of roughly the same period, last 20 or 30 years. You see here a pretty immense change going on in the global society. The best way to read the table is really, I mean, agreed, these categories are always fuzzy around the edges, but if you look at the right-hand columns, liberal democracy, 1975, 1995, until relatively recently, until the 1970s or so, most recognized liberal democratic systems were confined to Europe, North America, and Australasia. And there, you don't see very much change. A couple of military regimes have crumbled during that time. But democracy, in the sense of liberal democratic institutions, used to be fairly heavily concentrated in Western countries. What you see is this is becoming less and less so. If you like, there is a kind of globalization of democracy itself going on. Latin America used to be quite riddled with military regimes. Most of them, at least for the moment, have dissolved. Asia, same thing. You see a growth in liberal democratic systems. Africa, if you follow down, not so much the Middle East, but of course Eastern Europe, by definition, if you treat Soviet-style democracy as not really liberal democratic system. So if you compare the final figures, 35 countries in 1975 to some 78 in 1995, you can say there's been a dramatic doubling of the proportion of democratic governments in the world. Now, I don't propose in this lecture, since it's fairly short in time, to discuss the nuances of this table. You have to recognize that what is classified as democratic, as I say, is fuzzy around the edges. And of course, you can have reversals. It might not be the case that this is a trend that will be sustained. It might be the case that you'll have reversions in, who knows, whichever parts of the world. But I would like to propose to you anyway that it is a generic trend, that it is structural, that it is both an expression of and linked to wider globalizing processes. But to explain it, we need a better explanation than that which is ordinarily offered. The explanation which is ordinarily offered of the spread of democracy, I think, is a fairly simple one. And I think it is, more or less, again, you know, expressed very pithily, that democracy is best, or that liberal democratic institutions are best, both in terms of the morality which they enshrine, in other words, diversity of interest is represented, and in terms of their effectiveness as a way of recognizing citizens' interest within a society. This is the kind of view, I think, which has been conventional reaction to the collapse of communism. Communism collapsed because it was an authoritarian system. It wasn't very good economically, but it also simply didn't make enough space for people's concerns and interests. Liberal democracy is best, and everybody has sort of discovered that in the late 20th century. Now, there's a part of that I don't think one should quibble with, that is, liberal democracy is best in the sense in which there is no alternative, as I just mentioned, to a multi-party system, which is more democratic than a multi-party system. However, I think you can only really interpret this table, you can only explain what's going on in the world, if you also explain what I'd like to call the paradox of democracy. The paradox of democracy is this. At the same time, as this table shows, as liberal democratic institutions, parliamentary institutions, multi-party system is spreading across the world, at the same time as this is happening, there is increasing disaffection with and alienation from democratic institutions in those countries where those institutions are most firmly established. At the same time as democracy is spreading across the world, there is increasing disaffection with it in the heartlands of democracy in Western Europe, in the United States, and in Australasia and a few other places. You can measure this fairly easily. If you look at, for example, expressed levels of trust in politics and trust in political leaders, these have fallen sharply in most Western countries over the past 20 or 30 years. Much higher proportion of people used to express trust in political leaders and in orthodox parliamentary politics 20 or 30 years ago than do now. In quite a few countries, fewer people vote than used to be the case, and in most countries, there isn't the same kind of party loyalty as used to be true. You have a much higher proportion of volatile voters, some of whom only seem to make up their mind just before the election about who they're going to vote for. So at the same time as democracy is seemingly triumphing universally, it seems to be lapsing in the places where it is most effective and most historically located. As a backdrop to this, you should remember that the idea of democracy was never popular at all until the 20th century. That is, elites in the 19th century fiercely resisted the expansion of democratic institutions. Strongly resisted. It's only in the 20th century that everyone has mysteriously become a democrat, including the conservative elites who for a long time resisted the very idea. Well, what is going on? Why should it be that when an idea is becoming more and more popular across the world and spreading to different regions, that it seems to be losing its grip on those very populations who would seem to be supporting it at its core origins? I'd like to suggest to you anyway that the explanation for the two is the same. That is, it's the same set of changes that explain the generalization of democracy, that also explain increasing disaffection with democratic institutions in those countries where they're firmly established. These processes are those bound up with globalization. What globalization does is two things. Globalization is an uneven phenomenon, of course, but generically what it does is two things. First of all, it produces a more reflexive citizenry because globalization kind of invades local contexts of action, it gobbles up local customs and traditions, it forces you to live a more open, reflexive life. Citizenries, therefore, will never be again as passive as they used to be. I don't have time to talk about it in these lectures directly, but I think when you're talking about globalization, you're talking about two poles of change. You're talking about change at the global level, but you're talking also about changes in our personal lives. In our personal lives, what we're more or less forced to do is be more active and reflective on who we are, how we see the world, how we relate to the world, what patterns of behavior we follow, even our very identities become much more reflexive than they used to be. You have to think about them more consciously, you have to develop them more actively, and you have to do so in relation to a swirl of information. This is because, briefly put, the past dominates our lives much less than it used to do. We have to actively create a life for ourselves. That kind of creates a new kind of citizenry in relation to existing political structures. It questions political legitimacy because parliamentary institutions in many countries are based actually partly on traditional symbolism. They've also been compatible with a lot of backstage deals, old boy networks, and lots of other modes of functioning, which a more passive citizenry has sort of gone along with, but a more active citizenry, I feel, will no longer tolerate. The most obvious example here is the House of Lords, but there are many other illustrations of this. There is therefore a crisis of political legitimacy, which is partly bound up with societies in which people are much more active, more capable of reflecting on the world than they were before, not because they're more intelligent, but because there's a lot more information around. So the first thing to think is that more as a generalized, to some extent, global growth of reflexivity, consequent upon living on in a global mediatized society. The role of the media and television in this is a double one, as I think everybody is surely aware. I don't think you would have had the East European revolutions, the 1989 revolutions, without the influence of television. And the globalization of television as a kind of dialogic communication. I don't think you would have a peaceful transition in South Africa without this being part of a more generalized dialogue about democratization. TV and the media therefore open up a world of discourse, a public sphere. At the same time, as we all know, simultaneously they close it down because the media tend to have an impact on that public sphere, which reduces it to the everyday, to the instantaneous, which populates it with personalities rather than with issues, and which generally trivializes the very public sphere which it has helped open up. And we're living with that kind of ambivalent relationship to the media and other sources of communication information. Anyway, first major change associated with globalization, the generalized spread of a more reflexive citizenry, concentrated, of course, more in some societies than others, particularly in the developed countries, where detraditionalization is more pronounced and where the growth of information sources is too. Second, globalization goes along with the development of something like a more open information society. That open information society is carried by the very diversity of media that now exist, but also carried by the globalized nature of those media. You can't stop these sources of information. The Soviet Union was unable to prevent its population receiving information from a diversity of channels outside of the country itself. And this is true in a generalized fashion. It's the first time, I think, that governments have existed in the same information environment as their citizenry. In all previous types of society, I think it was possible for governments to exert much more control over information, to hoard it and to hide it. Secrecy has long been a part of the ways in which, even in the more democratic societies, politicians and others operated. It is much more difficult to do that in an open information environment, where, for example, things are available on your computer that you would never have been able to find out, even if you were very close to circles of government 20 or 30 years earlier. An open information society calls for a restructuring of the political sphere and a restructuring of democracy itself, because it tends to delegitimate how things have been done in the past. And I think you have to say lots of these things were not themselves democratic. That is, liberal democracy, no matter how good it is, now how much it has triumphed because there is no known alternative to it, was at the same time itself pervaded by traditional ways of doing things, by circumspect ways of doing things, by secrecy, and by all sorts of deals. If you look at the very interesting sort of range of corruption cases around the world, I haven't been to any country recently where there isn't some sort of corruption case going on involving politicians. Is it because they're always like that? Is it because there is a kind of new relationship between markets and government so that there are more opportunities for corruption? On the whole, I don't think so. I think what's happened, you know, it's a wild generalization, but what's happened by and large is that things that used to be invisible now are visible. And as they become visible, as it were, at the same time, higher standards are insisted upon. And I think corruption is often what was partly institutionalized previously. What used to be institutionalized as part of the system, for example, the Old Boy Network in this country, which seemed to be used to be the way in which a lot of politics work, whether in the Labour Party or in the Tory Party, is now seen to be illegitimate and corrupt, and indeed, from the point of view of universal norms of democracy, was illegitimate and corrupt. Now, if you follow this through, I think what follows from it is that, first of all, we can't suppose that liberal democracy is the only kind of democratic system which we should look to, or at least existing forms of liberal democracy. And second, we shouldn't accept, and it's no longer possible to accept, in an era of globalization, that democracy can be confined to the level of the nation, to the level of the nation state. In a globalized world, the structure of the nation state changes. We can all see that. Nation states remain powerful, but they're not. They don't have the same form or shape as they used to do, I think. This has happened in a very short period. So therefore, national politics can't have the same purchase that it used to do. It can't do also because there are so many events in the world which no longer originate from within the sphere of the nation. I think one of the reasons why people feel disillusioned with politicians, one of the reasons why people no longer have respect for politicians, is that they can see that politicians strut a sort of empty stage, that is, national politicians claim to deal with issues which we can all see they have little control over. These include, for example, ecological problems. You cannot resolve ecological problems purely on a national level. You have to do so to some extent on a local level, but also plainly on a global level. You can't resolve or cope with issues of global warming on the stage of national politics. It doesn't make any sense. Well, the same thing is true of world financial movements, of the movement of the global financial economy, and lots of other things happening in the world. So what's happening is the nation state is sort of being outflanked. You know, the American sociologist Daniel Bell invented a famous way of putting this, much, much quoted by other people who don't realize that Daniel Bell, I think, originally said it. We don't even know Daniel Bell was, but Daniel Bell said that the nation state becomes too big to deal with the small problems and too small to deal with the big problems. It's outflanked by a double process of decentralization below the level of the nation and the regrouping of forces above the level of the nation as globalizing forces start to bite. Well, how should we react to this? Now, there has been a certain reaction to it, I think, among political thinkers, which is simply to say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. A characteristic reaction over the past 20 or so years, even among people on the left, is simply to say, well, we can't control these things anymore. Therefore, politics is no longer important. Therefore, government is no longer important. Characteristic view of certainly those who think that markets are always more effective than governments is, well, let's just go along with this process, shrink the role of government, leave more and more in the hands of the marketplace. That's how the world is anyway. Government is ineffective, markets are always rational. We should go along with this process. We should reduce government as far as possible. Doesn't matter too much about democracy, because in a market there is a kind of democracy. You can always choose whether to shop at Sainsbury's or shop at Tesco. So there's already consumer choice built into the markets. That's been the dominant orthodoxy of the last 20 or so years. But that orthodoxy is now changing very rapidly. And it is false. I again, in a series of proposals, I would propose to you that what we need in the world is not less government, but more. But government can no longer be understood as simply national government. We have to look for both the expansion of governance and the expansion of democracy, below the level of the nation and above the level of the nation. These are realistic projects, not only realistic, these changes are actually happening all around us, partly through political activism, but partly because of other social and economic changes. At the same time, we have to address the lapses in national democratic systems. So I think if one's looking at this world of increasing democratization, there are three levels at which we can realistically speak, both in the extension of active government, not leaving everything just to free play of markets, and an extension of democracy going together. The reconstruction of national politics, national democracy, the emergence of transnational democratic systems, and the revival of local democracy or local democratic mechanisms. The reason why you need these three and why they become more possible rather than less is that the globalization does have this threefold impact. When you think of globalization, don't just think of it sucking away powers into the global arena. It does that to some degree. It also pushes down, it creates new pressures for autonomy, and as I mentioned last time, it squeezes sideways, creates new regions, new economic and cultural areas. All of these can be brought within the framework of government, and all in principle can be linked up to increasing democratization. As part of a political project today, therefore, we should be looking for the radicalization of democracy, but this can't mean for us what it meant for Marx. It doesn't mean any sort of return to democratic centralism. It means expanding democratic mechanisms on each of these three levels. Now, what would this involve? Let me just start of all from the, first of all, from the level of national politics itself, the classical form of liberal democracy. What is demanded, I argue anyway, on the level of national democratic systems in Western countries and elsewhere, is essentially a process of the democratizing of democracy. Because a liberal democracy, as I mentioned a bit earlier, was always based upon a whole range of non-democratic procedures, backstage deals, old boy networks, the sort of things I mentioned earlier. Democratization of democracy means constitutional reform, normally. It means an expansion of freedom of information legitimated within the democratic system. It normally, quite often, means a partial devolution of power. It means replacing the symbols of the old order with the realities of more democratic mechanisms. Different things in different countries. In this country, replacing the House of Lords with a more effective second chamber is certainly part of this process. Democratization of democracy is a package of constitutional reform devoted to greater transparency, to introducing and sustaining honesty in politics, and producing a more effective administrative structure for constitutional democratic change. I think democratizing democracy in this way does stand a chance of redressing the alienation for democratic mechanisms which many people feel. Because if you look at the survey material on Western countries, it shows people have lost confidence in politicians, but they haven't lost confidence in liberal democracy. Well over 90% of the populations of Western countries, and indeed most other countries, say that liberal democracy is the kind of system they want to live under. But they don't like the way in which it's currently organized. It is bureaucratized, it is distant, and in lots of ways it's not democratic. Second, it becomes eminently possible to look for modes of reviving local democracy. as linked to decentralization, devolutionary processes, because what globalization does, paradoxically, is to increase the power of the local community, to increase the power of the local arena. Because globalization has this threefold impact, because it produces this force driving people back towards local loyalties, to local affiliation, including, of course, the rise of local nationalisms and so forth, it does become really possible to revive local democratic systems. And so in most countries, I think you find contemplated and actually happening processes of local political reform. It's not impossible, I think, that these can involve forms of direct democracy too. All the talk of electronic democracy, a democracy which involves use of electronic technology, is much more likely to happen at a local level, actually, than it is at a national or transnational level. You have all sorts of experiments with local democracy going on around the world, some of them, I think, conspicuously successful. It is therefore possible to increase democracy downwards at the same time as you have structural reform at the national level. Finally, I also think that not only is it possible, but is actually developing a democracy above the level of the nation. Now, of course, you have to be careful with this, because at the end of the 19th century, people were speaking already of something like a cosmopolitan democracy emerging. And what happened was two horrific world wars and a century riven by war, really. But I think it is realistic for us again to speak of the possible emergence of what you could call a cosmopolitan democracy. Cosmopolitan democracy being democracy which exists right up to a global level. What can one see developing on this area? Well, the natural thing to think is to think, well, we should look to the United Nations, we should reform the United Nations, there should be some kind of direct election procedure to a constituent assembly of the United Nations, and there might perhaps be regional parliaments linked to the United Nations. I don't think all this is off the agenda. I think it is no longer wholly utopian to think this. But more interestingly, I think, than the old international associations like the United Nations, are the emergence of new forms of transnational association. International associations are nations who group together and have a kind of collective organization. The UN is like that. More interesting to me anyway is the European Union as the prime example of a transnational organization. It's a transnational organization because the nations who belong to the European Union, and this country of course does so only reluctantly, but the nations who belong to the European Union, I think for the first time, so far as I know in human history, have given up large areas of their sovereignty in order to do so. The European Union is not just, therefore, an aggregate of nations. It is a recognition, if you like, now anyway, it didn't start that way, but it's a recognition of the threefold impact of globalization. You have the emergence of institutions above the level of the nation, you have the reconstitution of the nation itself as part of the European Union, and you have regionalism and various forms of localism developing within the European Union countries. Now, the European Union, famously, is not democratic. Ulrich Beck, who's visiting here this term, has this famous quip about the European Union: if it applied to get into itself, it wouldn't, because it's not democratic enough to qualify for membership. It's still run largely by an arbitrary commission rather than by being a form of parliamentary democracy. But you do see the parliament flexing its muscles. Pauline Green, who's a governor of the LSE, as you've been following in the newspapers, has been one of the people flexing the muscles of the European Parliament. What you can do in Europe is to pioneer democratization above the level of the nation, which is not a super nation state, is not a federal state, contrary to what people say, it's not a federal state. I think it is something different. It is an active collaboration, reorganization of the three levels that globalization produces in the world system. It's confined, of course, to one part of the world, but it seems to me what's important about the European Union is not that it's European. It is that it is a governmental response to globalization, which could, and I think will, be also develop in other parts of the world. I think it's logical, for example, both in East Asia and in certainly Latin America, to envisage the emergence of an architecture of governance similar to this. Now, lots of questions will be asked about whether transnational governance is possible, but I feel it is both possible and that it can be linked to forms of economic global governance too. It is no good us living in a global, turbulent economy in which the East Asian countries one day are healthy and the next day are sick, not because of changes within themselves, but because of the flux of global capital. The world stands in need of greater economic governance, stability in the currency regime, and an attempt to cope with the yawning inequalities which exist in the global society. You can only do this by a more effective governance at a world level. We should be looking to combine that with the expansion of democratization. This is no longer a wholly utopian thing to do. It leaves us, therefore, with a lot of possibilities for democracy, but of course, a lot of exceptions to it, too. In spite of the spread of global democratization, you should remember that there are many authoritarian regimes. There are people still in prison in China and other countries for human rights violations or other kinds of political crime. Democracy has a long way to go, but it has become, I think, it's begun anyway, a very effective long journey marching through the institutions of the global society. Look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks very much.